The St. Augustine Institute of Catholic Studies presents Brother Francis with his regular Tuesday night lecture. This is Tuesday, October 15th, 1985. Brother Francis.
In nomine Patris et Filii Spiritus Sancti. Amen. Ave Maria, gratia plena Dominus tecum, benedicta tu mulieribus, et benedictus fructus ventris tui, Iesus. Sede sapientiae, Sancta Theresia, in nomine Patris et Filii Spiritus Sancti. Amen. If you examine the kinds of knowledge you have in your mind, you can reduce them to four different categories. There are some things you know philosophically. Every one of us has done some philosophic meditation. We have read books. We have studied philosophers. Some scientific. Everybody here has had some course in physics, chemistry, biology, bacteriology, whatever. Some theological things that we only know because God revealed them and we learned them from the church, from our parents, from our traditions. But the large mass of the knowledge that we all must have is what we might, for lack of a better term, call common sense. We have an awful lot of common sense knowledge. It's not methodical, it's not systematic, it's not organized, but it has certain benefits and advantages that the other disciplines do not possess. For one thing, it's very human. For a second thing, it remains a kind of a complete totality. You never become narrow. The person remains integral with his knowledge of common sense. The kind of thing that he might lose if he gets into some specialization without any reflection or any protection from some other discipline. And last week, I was reading you the article which I intended to be a kind of introduction for the course we will be beginning in November, The Dangers of Scientism. The first part of it, where I stopped, was a defense of common sense knowledge. And a defense of common sense knowledge is really a defense of humanity. Of all the billions of people who live in the world today, who have lived before us, what percentage have been either scientists or philosophers or theologians? It's not 0.0001%. So the general mass of people have the knowledge of intelligence, of common sense, of common experience. To despise that is really to despise men. To despise that leads to that snobbishness they call elitism. People can be very wise, very virtuous, very holy. They can go to heaven on the kind of knowledge they have, where they use their intelligence that God gave them humanly, wholesomely, but without necessarily becoming either scientists or philosophers. Well, tonight I'm going to continue from there by beginning to show that common sense has its own limitations. It's not, and it is a matter of common sense that it should be so, that God intends us to seek excellence. He gave us powers and he likes to see us use them. I have said it many times, God never revealed to us the rules of architecture. He told us that we should love him and worship him, but he didn't tell us exactly how. He left it to the human genius to develop the arts and the disciplines that will be for his service. So some people think that they can snub human activity and that's pleasing to God. That's not true. We are his creatures, we were made in his image and likeness. And while we cannot be creators because we are not omnipotent, God likes us to be the way a child can try to imitate his father, creative. And so all the creative activities of men are blessed by God. And so we don't want to snub the general mass of men that remain simple-hearted and innocent, but very intelligent. We cannot depreciate that kind of intelligence, but we cannot use that as a principle to discourage people from seeking excellence, especially when they have the talent for it. That would be another wrong approach, certainly not Catholic. So I want to continue with this article. All the time we are preparing for the course we will begin in November, which will aim at giving us a complete outlook on the universe that is thoroughly Catholic, that's a scaffolding for our faith, but also that regulates all the other disciplines of reason, like science and art and law and politics and so on, education, the way they should be when man is acting as God intended him to act, that means intelligently, reasonably. So I will continue my article on the dangers of scientism. And so I am assuming that we all know that one of the first dangers is that it can depreciate common sense. And by that, it really depreciates man as such. But common sense knowledge has its limitations, as the man of common sense very well knows. By mere common sense, no airplane can be constructed and no medical operation can be performed. When the man of common sense needs to build a bridge, he does not go to another man of common sense. Instead, he uses his common sense and goes to an engineer. It must be evident, therefore, that if we would have many of the things we consider desirable, common sense knowledge would no longer be sufficient and scientific knowledge becomes necessary. But the discipline that is required for the acquisition of scientific knowledge makes that wholeness, that completeness of common sense knowledge impossible on the scientific plane. No man can possess technical scientific knowledge about everything. And therefore, everyone must specialize in that part of knowledge needed for his profession or for his function in society. Further, in contrast with the spontaneity of common sense and the directness with which it envisages its objectives, we find that science requires intricate and roundabout processes for its attainment. This makes it quite possible for man to lose every perspective of relevance and to proceed along blind alleys of knowledge and research that lead nowhere. And yet all this is unavoidable and follows from the very nature of science. It would be absurd to ask a medical student to justify in terms of ultimate human purposes every single action or assignment required in his general training for his profession. Hence we have another danger of specialized training. Namely, one man is trained to know a part of reality and to deal even with this part in a manner that is systematically artificial, this man develops more as a function than as a person. Hence it is that science and technology carry the danger of depersonalizing social relations. But man insists on being a person and on being treated as such. And as a person, he insists on his right of somehow knowing all reality and being concerned about his destiny as a complete man. Therefore, once his common sense perspective gets to be distorted by the artificial mold which frames his mind in a special field, he tends to raise his special field and partial science up to the dignity of a universal science. That's how we get so many monisms. There's only one universal science, and what we call it? Ontology, and we shall see why. But if anything takes that the place of ontology and tries to be the one universal science, you are in trouble. All reality is made up of material atoms or quantums of energy, says the physicist, one monism. Reality is a mysterious life force, elan vital, retorts the biologist, who would see all things from the window of biology. All history is made by economic forces, Marx, or by sexual energy, Freud. These and similar monisms represent some of the grave dangers of scientism. So you can add now another danger of scientism. What is it? Monisms. One principle being made the only principle for explaining everything. One, it is not the only principle that explains everything. See, that's a distortion. And then we have what's perhaps the greatest danger of scientism, and you know what we mean by scientism. It's not science, it is the abuse of science. We have what's perhaps the greatest danger of scientism, namely the philosophy of positivism. We associate it in history with Auguste Comte, the French philosopher. But it had had, in our time, it's almost a universal philosophy in the colleges. They call it positivism because, as we heard Professor Gavant speak, they only admit knowledge when it is arrived at by the scientific method. If it cannot be arrived at by the scientific method, well, they just don't know anything about it. So it ends up being the most negative of all philosophies, and yet they call it positivism. That's The primary interest of the special sciences is not the contemplative understanding and appreciation of reality, but the control of the visible world for practical purposes. In order to harness the powers of nature, all the knowledge needed is knowledge of certain accidental aspects of material things. Such an accident as the quantity of the thing is all that remains of reality when the real thing is replaced by a measure and is introduced into a mathematical formula. Of course, any child can tell you that the quantity of a thing is not its complete reality. You weigh 200 pounds, is that the most important fact about you, or just the 200 pounds? But the scientific expert tends to identify the quantity with the whole thing. Now, when we come to cosmology, we are going to see how universal this tendency is in the way the scientists talk today. And all of us who have been educated in these disciplines, we discover that we think that way. I mean, I haven't got it out of my system yet. I, in principle, I know it's fallacy, but just to identify the color with the wavelength, to identify and so on. I mean, I can go on and on and on, but just the beginning. Of course, any child can tell you that the quantity of a thing is not its complete reality, but the scientific expert tends to identify the quantity with the whole thing. Hence we get those quantitative ghosts called by such names as energy, mass, atomic number, wavelength, intelligence quotient, etc., floating around the scientific graveyards where the objects of common sense are deeply buried, and parading in the garbs of the real and substantial entities. When this tendency of the sciences is built up into a complete philosophy, a worldview which denies the substance of things, denies the reality of causes, and admits only those surface accidents or appearances of material things which can be measured and made subject to the scientific method, when this thing happens, we get that most negative of all philosophies, named, ironically, the philosophy of positivism. Now, neither God nor the spiritual soul can be made subject to measurement or to test tube analysis. Therefore, the positivist rejects on principle all metaphysics and all religion. Methodically, there's no, in this method, in this system, there's no place. Now, regardless whether they exist or not, according to their own pre-established method, they are eliminated. But now, having seen some of the dangers of scientism, let us proceed to study the nature of science. This will lead us to determine whether philosophy is a science. The Greeks and the scholastic philosophers considered philosophy the science par excellence. But to the modern mind, this view cannot be taken for granted. It has to be defended and justified. What is a science, and how does scientific knowledge differ from the knowledge of common sense? The most superficial observation reveals to us that what we call sciences possess a certain form and order, that is, they are organized bodies of knowledge and not random collections of fact. A book, whether it is physics, chemistry, biology, it's not just like an almanac where all kinds of items supposedly true, but just put collected and put side by side. Now, this order of the sciences is not imposed on them externally like the alphabetical order of a dictionary. It is an order which mirrors and reveals the order of real things. The sciences have order because they put things together as things flow from common origins, principles, or causes. Science begins as soon as things begin to be systematically and methodically explained. And the more explained things are, the more orderly they appear to be. Man, therefore, can be said to have sciences because he asks questions and seeks explanations of things that fall within his experience. And man is a great question asker. Have you ever seen a child just beginning to use his mind? What are they doing all the day? Ask questions. As a matter of fact, man is the only question asker in the whole universe. You could almost define man by this property, which flows from his very essence. Now, here is the reason why man asks questions. The human mind is made for a reality which is absolute, necessary, and simple, and which contains the sufficient reason for its being. This reality is, of course, God. Once the mind sees God, our intelligence is so thoroughly satisfied that it can raise no further questions, because no problem or mystery remain, either in God himself or in anything he caused. And there is nothing in existence that did not receive its being from the first being. But when the human mind is confronted with a contingent reality, so I am using words that are going to be studied in the course, and when I get one of them, I do what is equivalent to underlining. I just dwell a little bit on it. Contingent reality. What do you mean by contingent reality? But when the human mind is confronted with a contingent reality which does not possess within itself a sufficient reason for its existence, the mind immediately tries to explain this reality. And explaining a thing means reducing it ultimately to a cause or principle which does not need to be explained. To put what we have just said in more philosophic terms, we could say that the mind knows with absolute certainty that there must be a sufficient reason for everything that is. We will be studying in ontology the principle of sufficient reason, one of the supremest principles of philosophy. But when you come to it in ontology, it won't be like that's the first time you were ever in contact with it. That's why we say we are in ontology already, even before we get to our eighth course. If we didn't know that, we would never see the why of a growing tree or of a falling apple. Remember in logic we spoke about those major premises that are never expressed. You proceed with enthymemes, but they are the lights that guide the progress of the argument. The principle of sufficient reasons is one of these lights. You could say to a scientist, to a physicist, you know, that you believe in the principle of sufficient reason, and you say, well, I never need it, I don't need it in physics. Well, everything he's doing there is illuminated by that principle, but he has just never put it in words. This thirst for explanation is in our intellects and not in our senses. The senses have no principle of sufficient reason. The senses just receive what comes to them, that's all. They don't ask questions. Animals never ask questions and never attain science. The stream of sense experience received in any skin, in my skin, from a flowing river, does not raise any questions. But the notion of movement abstracted by my mind raises the problem of change and starts the mind along the track of science. And we know the problem of change was the very first problem for both science and philosophy. And that will be our subject. Why will it be our subject in cosmology? What is the subject matter of cosmology? A being in change. Ens mobile. Remember that word? The number of the sciences could be very large, because in addition to the great variety of objects that could be studied scientifically, there is a great variety of aspects from which to study things. A chair, for example, could be studied in physics. Can you see what things could be studied about a chair in physics? The strength of material, the balance, the weight, the gravity, and so on. In chemistry, in economics, the same material chair could fit into every one of these sciences. And man may be studied in anatomy and in politics. In each case, the material object is one, but the formal object different. You see, my method in teaching philosophy, I prefer to start using the term correctly before I give a formal definition of it. I mean, some people begin with a formal definition. So every time a sentence occurs here, there are philosophic terms in it. And by seeing them dynamically, you begin to see what they mean. Later on, we will take time and give a kind of an exposé in repose of the definition of these fundamental terms. All sound, intelligent thought must begin in clear terms. That's why I advise you once, and I repeat it in case you forgot, whenever you are reading a good book, an important book, the product of a good mind, always have a good dictionary right beside you and keep improving your vocabulary. That's not the total structure of a good mind, but that is the first foundation, clear concepts. But this variety of the sciences forms a natural hierarchy. That's a very important thing. One of the greatest insights of wisdom is to recognize that there is a hierarchy of truths, and that among the sciences there is a hierarchy, that things do not fall on the same level. For example, biology is superior to bacteriology, physics to metallurgy, astronomy to navigation, and economics to banking. I could go on and say, and ethics to politics. Now that, the divorcing of politics from ethics, was the beginning of all the brutality we have watched in our time. Machiavellianism. That's Stalin, that's Hitler, that's every brutal force that's trying to parade as a legitimate authority. You see, these are all the things that philosophy is fighting against to try to restore the normal standards. What determines this hierarchy? The principle of explanation in which the very essence of science consists. The superior sciences come closer to giving an ultimate explanation. In every case mentioned above, the superior science explains the principle of the inferior science and defines its basic concept. Hence, the inferior science of each pair presupposes the superior science and depends upon it for being a science at all. Metallurgy presupposes the ordinary laws of general physics, such as the laws of heat and light, the principle of specific gravity, the laws of magnetism, and so on. If one were to stop and give a sufficient explanation of every term occurring in the science of metallurgy, one would have to include the greater part of general physics in every chapter on metallurgy. But of course, physics is ordinarily studied before you get into metallurgy. It's supposed to be taken for granted. The hierarchy of the sciences is therefore a hierarchy of explanation. But along with this mark, others follow, stemming from it and depending upon it. The superior science is in every case of a greater general interest and is valuable as knowledge in itself and for itself, while the inferior science is primarily of practical interest and is valued on that account. No one studies metallurgy in order to become better educated. If you don't have practical interest in metals, you don't go into that field. Close to the top of this hierarchy, we find such sciences as physics, biology, and mathematics. Yet none of these sciences is ultimate, not even in their respective orders of knowledge. No book on geometry, for example, discusses the nature of quantity, continuity, shape, dimension, point, number, measure, space, etc. Geometry takes all these concepts for granted, just as it also presupposes its axioms and the general method of demonstration. The same could be said about physics and biology with regard to their basic notions and principles, such as the notion of matter, change, mass, energy, entropy, atom, field of force, life, generation, etc. Now the word entropy occurs here, and we hear it mentioned repeatedly in these debates on evolution. And it is a subject I have given very special attention to for a long time, and sometime I will develop it with you. But just very simply speaking, the two most general laws of all the natural events, processes. If you look at all that's happening in the world, water flowing, wind blowing, the rain falling, the sun shining, the sky moving, all of these things. The two most general laws are the first and second laws of thermodynamics, they call them. And what they really mean is a law of conservation. That's the first law of thermodynamics. Something is conserved. They used to say once matter, mass is conserved. Well, now they find that mass can be destroyed, but then appear as energy. They used to say energy is conserved. Now they also find that there is an interchange between mass and energy. So now they say a conservation of some quantity, some basic quantity. Now the significance of this law is going to be one of the major things we'll be attacking. So I'm just presenting it for the first time just to know it. something is conserved. Let's put it that way now. The second law of thermodynamics says there is a tendency to deterioration. They call it an increase in entropy, but that's an unfortunate... they conceived entropy in such a way that a negative is thought about positively. Then an increase of entropy is a decrease in order. You might say entropy is almost synonymous with disorder, with running down. Things left to themselves run down. They never run up. That's the principle of entropy. And we will see how tremendously universal it is and how it is ultimately a property of matter, and to correctly look at it, it's a property of matter in our falling universe. It has to link up with some bigger principle. I used to watch as a child how many forces in nature are cyclical. You like to think of the cycle of water. It evaporates in the oceans, rises up in the sky, forms clouds, falls down on the mountains and valleys and fields, so on, runs into rivers, back to the ocean. The quantity of water in the world has neither increased nor decreased. When the cycle finishes, it finishes exactly where it started. Now, a great deal of Oriental religion and Oriental philosophy make that a supreme principle and say everything is cyclic, the great circle. We shall see in the different theories about the universe how they abuse that. Now, some things are cyclic. The mechanistic conception of the universe, every single thing that is purely mechanistic can be reversed. The same watch that can be wound can be unwound. Every mechanistic operation can be reversed. Now, the law of entropy is to tell us that there are things that are not reversible. And I remember watching and seeing the mud going down with the water, and I say, all right, the water is going to complete its circle, you know, started in the ocean, back to the ocean. But how about the mud? What's going to bring that back to the mountains? So something in me began to see that what I was observing as a child really is what I was learning later as a scientist, then as a philosopher, to be the law of entropy. There are irreversible processes. And of course, all life is irreversible. Let me see any of you grow back to be a child. So there is a principle of what is irreversible, and the tendency is always for running down. And you say, how could there be conservation and at the same time running down? Well, that's what we are going to learn even in science before we come to philosophy. The quantity of energy will always be the same, at least of matter energy. But the availability of energy will not be the same. And we shall see what that means. And the fact that energy is becoming less and less available is what they call the law of increasing entropy. So don't let that word increasing fool you, because entropy is fundamentally a negative concept. It's like a man increasing in ignorance. But anyway, all these concepts that we study them in science, that arise out of science, cannot become a complete total outlook on the universe, whether constructive or destructive, until a philosophy comes in. And of course, a philosophy does have some kind of power, as there are different kinds of wisdom. But the only philosophy that is truly constructive and that does not destroy what is revealed about the universe and is a sound foundation for morality is the Philosophia Perennis that we defend. We shall see why later. Let us suppose that a philosopher and a scientist were to witness together. Now let me see, did I skip here? All these sciences, insofar as they are sciences, that is, insofar as they possess any explanatory value, presuppose the superior philosophic sciences of logic, cosmology, rational psychology, and ethics. Now these are all courses we will be taking. So So if God gives us enough life to go through this course, we will have gone through all of these. And these philosophic sciences in turn presuppose ontology or general metaphysics. I'm going to keep talking about ontology. And what does it mean? The philosophy of being. On in Greek means the same thing as ens in Latin. So it's named by its Greek name. It's the philosophy of being. And since everything that the mind can think about or that can be is a being, it's the most universal philosophy that could be. And it's what brings back order and unity to what had divided us and divided the world. What ontology studies about a being is more important than anything said about that being in any other science. As I told you, it's more important that a cow is than that it is a cow. At least to the philosopher. I guess if you are interested in milk, you might have a different point of view. Is there any approach to reality more important than to study a thing insofar as it is one, true, good, and beautiful? Well, of course, I am giving now the transcendentals, and that will be studied in ontology, all of them. Supposing you take a society and remove from it all institutions and persons concerned with the attainment and expression of truth, goodness, beauty, how much of the society is worth having? Well, you probably recognize the pattern. That's what the communists do the moment they take over. Everybody that's concerned with truth or goodness or beauty, they line them up and shoot them. And they have done it to millions of people. And when we speak about this, I mean, some of the people that have lived under communism, when they talk to me or to you, no matter how much you are supposed to be very militant and so on, they don't think you know what it is. I mean, it's all abstract and so far away and so on. But that's exactly what they do. Supposing you take, okay, or let us take the history of man and remove from it the stories of its philosophers, scientists, poets, artists, saints, and mystics, how much of what is left of that history is worth studying? As ontology studies all these attributes of being, it studies things insofar as they reflect the perfections of God. So that is another way of looking at what is ontology. It's studying the first being and how his attributes are reflected in the second beings. And what are the second beings? Everything else outside of God. For God alone is supremely one, supremely true, good, and beautiful. Ontology thus establishes the highways on which the mind constantly travels from the world to God and from God to the world. Moreover, ontology raises, formulates, and answers all the most basic problems which torment the minds of men in all ages and which underlie all great literature. What are the problems that all literature revolves around? Three. It's a reflection of the Blessed Trinity. Now, I've given that to many, many people and challenged them to deny that basic truth. It sounds like an oversimplification, but not all simplifications are oversimplifications. There are simplifications which imply the discovery of simplicity, of what is simply true. What are the three problems that all literature deals with? The problem of being, and within it is contained the problem of change, the problem of evil, and the problem of knowledge. All these problems are solved in ontology as well as it is possible for the human mind to do it. But then, have we any right to call ontology a science? According to modern usage, when we say science, we understand primarily something like, you would name them, physics, bacteriology, certainly a science, or perhaps even sociology. Some would call that a science. It should be clear, however, from our discussion that the notion of science applies primarily to ontology, secondarily to the other philosophic sciences, and only in a very weak sense to the special sciences. So it's only in the third grade, but now we take these special sciences have usurped the term. And that is part of the deterioration of values in the minds of men. We live in a intellectually decadent age, and part of that decadence is how terms run down. But since the discussion has been a little too general so far, I would like to illustrate by a concrete example the contrast between the philosophic and the scientific outlooks, using the word scientific now in accordance with the modern usage. So when you say scientist today, how do people use it? Let us suppose that a philosopher and a scientist were to witness together the death of a man. The scientist would ask, why did this man die? And he would seek an explanation in such things as poison or heart failure. On the other hand, the philosopher perceives immediately a more fundamental problem. He would like to know not simply the accidental reason why this man died, but rather why anybody should die at all. The investigations of the scientist might contribute to the sciences and arts of medicine, pharmacy, and perhaps even chemistry. The reasonings of the philosopher, on the other hand, lead to a better understanding of a composite material being in contrast with a simple spiritual being, and therefore to a deeper understanding of God and of man. Science goes hand in hand with the practical arts and art crafts, with medicine, farming, engineering, industry, etc., while philosophy associates with religion, poetry, and the contemplative arts. The contemplative arts is another name for the fine arts. Now, all these are going to be studied when the time comes for them, but we have to be prepared for them ahead of time. Put in the language of philosophy, the difference between philosophy and the sciences can be expressed in the following terms. Philosophy seeks the ultimate explanation, while science is satisfied with the proximate causes of things. That defines philosophy and science also by way of contrast. Now, as far as the mind is concerned, proximate explanation is really no explanation at all. It explains only for practical purposes. To know that water can be decomposed into oxygen and hydrogen is useful information in case you are interested in manufacturing either of the two gases, but it certainly fails to explain the mystery of chemical union. And besides, the problems of science presuppose those of metaphysics. Man would not seek the precise cause of malaria unless he knew that things like malaria must have a cause. For obviously, the scientist does not try to determine whether malaria has a cause, but rather what the cause is. See what we mean by the presuppositions? These are the suppressed premises that people don't direct their attention to them directly until they are interested in something more than the practical order. For obviously, the scientist obviously knows that a contingent thing like malaria must have a cause, although he does not develop the notion of a contingent being and the notion of a cause, nor does he care, as a scientist, to reason out all these implications. Were the scientist to stop and reflect on these matters, he would move out of the field of science and into the field of philosophy. Philosophy, therefore, not only has the title to be called science, but has it in the highest degree. It is, as already intimated, the queen among the sciences. Now, I think, enough of this type of thing, because it's a little tedious, and I will continue next week. We still have some time to finish the article. How much time I still have? Good. Now, the next thing I want to do in this period of preparation, this month of October that is getting us warmed up for what will come in November, I want to give you some notes that I have worked on many, many years back. You have no conception of the hours that went into this, but they were very joyful hours, because they were hours of prayer and contemplation. I made copies for everybody here of three pages of this. It's going to be a little booklet that will join the course, and you will all have built up your own notes. When I gave you the course on logic, I had done the notes years back, and they were all ready to distribute. But in this course, we are going to be building up our own little book, everybody. Now, Sister has not acquired for us the container, and I don't trust you with the sheets. So, so I will read my own notes, but I will not distribute these notes, because I think you will lose them, or before you know it, you the whole place will be littered here. The title of this introductory item, see, these are all introductory items to our course, is the cosmology of faith and revelation. And the way I'm going to introduce it is this. I'm going to suppose that this door suddenly opens and two gentlemen walk in. One, well, let's say Mr. Gavan that we heard talk the other day, a scientist. The other, but you have to use your imagination, our father Abraham, the father of all those who believe, of the faithful. And so, supposing we invite the two gentlemen to sit down here, I say that Mr. Gavan would know what we mean when we talk about electrons and molecules and the cells of the body and electromagnetic waves and things like that. Our father Abraham would know nothing of all this jargon. It just means nothing to him. I still insist that we as believers have the same fundamental conception of the universe as Abraham, and not at all as Dr. Gavan. And what is the fundamental conception of the universe that we share with all those who believed from the days of our father and mother, Adam and Eve, right down to our own day, that we would share with all the saints? Saint Teresa of Avila would be most comfortable with our universe and most uncomfortable with the universe of Mr. Gavan or Mr. Einstein or whoever is representing science. And I want to say that, having been a scientist myself, when science is properly understood, there is nothing in it that would subvert the universe of faith and revelation. Not at all. But it requires some analysis, because out of the experiences of the different sciences, we do have all kinds of models of the universe that absolutely subvert not only faith, but morality. And that is why our work here is such a crusade. And a crusade means war. Don't ever forget, what we mean by crusade is war. And war can only end in two ways, either with defeat or with victory. We have not won yet, but we have not yet been defeated, so the war is on. And greater battles are coming in the future than in the past. Now I'll begin, maybe I will have enough time to read you the first page, but you will all have these, and these are not things just to read once, like you read the editorials of the Boston Globe. These are things to be studied carefully. I wouldn't be surprised if you don't all end up memorizing everything that's on this page. On this first page, I have 9 definitions. I introduce it first by some initial definitions. I really don't come to the word of our father Abraham till the next page, but some important definitions. Number 1, wisdom. Wisdom is the most perfect knowledge of the most important truths in the right order of emphasis, accompanied by a total, permanent disposition to live accordingly. So when we say we are seeking wisdom, that's what we are seeking. To say the most perfect knowledge assumes that we know that man has knowledge in many different grades of perfection. And we shall see that, like you say, do you know Mr. Carter? Yes, I read about him in the papers. Do I know him? If I met him and had dealings with him and so on, you see how my knowledge becomes more perfect. There's the knowledge of vision and the knowledge of knowing about. So, you see the difference? All our senses are instruments of knowledge, our eyes, our ears, and so on. But our intellect deals with knowledge of a higher order. However, there is vividness in the knowledge of the senses that's lacking in the intellect. When we have in the state of glory the beatific vision, it's not going to be primarily in the senses, although there will be reflections of its effect into the senses, but it will be the vividness in the order of the spirit that we hear in this life only enjoy in the order of the senses. That's why the mystics like to use the senses when they talk, but their language is not what the ordinary people really understand. You have to be very, very careful there. The second word defined is philosophy. Philosophy is natural wisdom, because there is a wisdom that's given to us by God, by revelation, Holy Scripture. Philosophy is natural wisdom. It is the science of things through their ultimate causes, attained by the light of reason. The third word defined is the subject of our next course, cosmology. Cosmology is a philosophic science which begins in the examination of the sensible universe, considered as the realm of changing reality, or, in the language of philosophy, Latin, ens mobile. It terminates in a complete intelligent grasp of the order of the universe. Cosmology is somehow wisdom, but not first wisdom. That's borrowed from Aristotle. 4, order. That word first, watch it. Some of the most important words in philosophy are the ones that sound kind of very ordinary. And you have to know what a philosopher means when he says first and second. God is the first being. Every other being is being dependently on the first being, and so on. We will discuss that much more fully later. Order. Order is the exact adaptation of things to their ends. Now that word ends, that things do have ends, that's one of the most important deficiencies of the material sciences. What is the word for end in Latin, Greek? Telos. And what is the philosophy preoccupied with ends, or that recognizes ends? Teleology. And a tremendous important assignment of Philosophia Perennis is to restore teleology to thought, to see that things are meant for ends. Aristotle analyzed 4 causes, and what's the 4th cause that he considered the most important? The end, finis, the purpose of things. Somebody was telling me, they stood half an hour on Harvard Square and they were watching what people look like. And Father says, you know exactly what, you know their thoughts by what they look like. What is the most obvious shouting thing there? Complete absence of purpose. they have lost the very conception of the end of things. Five, essence. Essence is the reality of a thing as manifest to the mind. It is the answer to the question, what is, or in Latin, quid est. Hence, it is also called whatness or quiddity. Now, as long as you are in philosophy, you are always talking about the essence of things. That's the most important word. If I were to say, what's the most important word to a philosopher? I would say essence. So I give an initial definition, but we'll be talking about it much more later. Nature. Nature is the essence of a thing considered as the principle of its actions and its passions, of what a thing can do, suffer, or resist. Now you can apply it even to our faith. What do we mean when we say our Lord had one person but two natures? He was always God in all eternity. As God, they could not have nailed him to the cross, you see? It's when he has a human nature that you can crucify him. That's what nature is, that the essence of the thing as the basis of what a thing can do or what can be done to it. And that these words are going to occur over and over. A material being is one existing in space and time, subject to change, even to the very destruction of its nature. And that's what we will be studying. One of the first things we will study is substantial change. Every material being is subject to substantial change. In the case of man, what is substantial change? Death, when we die. It looks like the same man there, but the man isn't there. There's something. The same material body, but that's substantial change. But substantial change is not something that occurs only when you are a man. Every material entity, the molecule of water, when it turns into oxygen and hydrogen, it has undergone substantial change. The nature of water has been destroyed. A spiritual being is one capable of existing and acting without intrinsically depending on matter. It is not subject to substantial change. A spiritual substance, once in being, will endure everlastingly. The material universe, number 9, is the material universe. It's the total reality perceived by our senses as a continuous process in space and time. Now, the next item is, do I have time anymore? 1 minute? The next item, credo in unum Deum patrem omnipotentem factorem caeli et terrae visibilium omnium et invisibilium. The moment you say that sentence, you have divided yourself from every false philosophy going just on that one profession of faith, the very first article of the creed, and you have put your hand in the hand of our father Abraham, because he believed that 100%, exactly as we believe it today. In nomine Patris et Filii Spiritus Sancti, Amen. Ave Maria, gratia piena Dominus tecum, benedicta tu in mulieribus, et benedictus fructus ventris tui, Jesus. Sedes sapientiae, Sancta Theresia. In nomine Patris et Filii Spiritus Sancti, Amen.